Well, I think that is our cue to begin. So thanks for joining us. We're here to talk about optimizing Azure Virtual Machines for performance and availability. my name is Pete Zerger. I am Microsoft MVP, a CTO of an American consulting company called Infront, and here with my fine Swedish colleague from Microsoft.
My name is Anders Bengtsson. I'm a principal PFE working with System Center.
That's all you have to say.
Yeah.
So principal PFE says it all, huh? Nice. I apologize. So Anders is a principal Premier Field Engineer now, newly promoted. So I failed to change the slide. Coming in late 2014, this is a book I think you and your family will enjoy very much. So maybe one for every room of the house. It's great for the bathrooms for sure. So today we're going to focus on three areas of Microsoft Azure Virtual Machine. So we're talking about infrastructure as a service, just to be clear. We're all, I think, for the most part, IT pro more than developer, so I think that probably works out. We'll talk about performance and scale. We'll move into some availability discussions. We'll wrap up with some monitoring and management, and that management's going to include a smidge of self-service. Just to get a good understanding of where you are today, we wanted to take a quick poll of where you are with Azure in your environment. So how many of you are using Azure maybe in free capacity with your MSDN subscriptions or something similar? Wow, okay, and how many of you are using Azure for live workloads like test, development, or production? All right, and how many are thinking about it, want to get a little better understanding of architecture, et cetera, so maybe a few more. Yeah, so we're pretty evenly distributed, kind of what we expected, honestly, right? So we're seeing sort of the uptick on Azure here a lot in recent months, which means we all haven't had time to inject that into our production environments for sure. So why don't we start with performance? So everybody is familiar with virtualization, right? With Hyper-V, with vSphere, insert your virtualization platform here. Azure Virtual Machine performance in many respects is just like any Windows VM. You know, how much you can squeeze out of a virtual machine depends on your subsystems, right? CPU, memory, disk. Azure VMs differ in that every Azure VM has exactly one network adapter, which means there are certain things we can't do. So we'll do things differently in that respect. But you see these virtual machine sizes here. These are the image sizes. And so where in Hyper-V or vSphere I might just open the UI and set exactly how many cores I would like, set my dynamic memory, etc., with Azure VMs, I have to choose an image. so I need to look at my workload. You know, if we take something like a System Center, let's take an Operations Manager Management Server. A role like that tends to be more CPU and memory intensive, and disk is less important. But maybe you have a disk intensive workload. So maybe IOPS are going to rule what you drive. So you'll notice that we have here the combinations behind Anders' noggin there. Just come over here. Come over here with me, son. So you see we have CPU and memory and then the number of disks. Now you notice I have a range on some of those disks. We'll talk about the finer points of your disk IOPS, but you may find that you have an application that requires two cores and a really small amount of memory, but you have this massive, you know, disk-intensive workload, so you might have to pick a larger VM image so you can get up to, if you need to get up to 8,000 IOPS, you're going to be looking maybe at more CPU and memory than you need. So it's going to depend on the workload, which means it's not always going to be a perfect world. so let's talk about storage concepts for a moment. You have three types of disks in Azure. You have an operating system disk. Can you guess what's on the OS disk? Yeah? We have a data disk, which we typically use for application data. I can add up to 16 disks per VM, depending on my size here, right? So we see with the images we have a maximum number of disks. So my IOPS will rule in that respect. So you'll notice there are two tiers of disks. When Anders does some work later, we'll likely point this out. There is a box where we can pick a service tier, and a basic tier gives us 300 IOPS, up to 300 IOPS per disk, up to 500 per disk. It's actually good that I said up to, because he was coming over to hit me on the back of the head there. And you'll notice the maximum size here. So your OS disk is going to be 127 gig. That's as big as it gets, which means I cannot migrate a bigger disk in there from my OS without doing a little work. And then my data disks can be up to 1 terabyte each. You good there, anything? So your disks have to be stored somewhere in Azure. You're going to do that inside an Azure storage account. Within an Azure storage account, I can create containers. Think of them as folders. I have a container in my MSDN Azure subscription called VHDs, and I store my VM disks up there. They're stored as blobs. You'll notice each of my blobs actually has a URL, which will explain itself in just a moment. You can have many containers based on how you would like to organize your disks. We can have up to 500 terabytes in a storage account. I can have up to 20,000 IOPS in a storage account. I can have up to 20 storage accounts in my Azure subscription. So I can take that 500 terabytes times a bunch.
There's a star there.
Well, so there is a star there. Do you want to speak to the star?
Yeah, so if you manage to use all 20 and you need more and you have some good justification for that, there might be solutions to get more storage accounts.
Yeah, so if you call Microsoft, certainly there are some possibilities there. Yeah. When I talked about that, Anders said there's a secret process there where you can escalate and get more should you need to go beyond 20.
Exactly.
As your cloud strategy sort of matures, that's actually well within the realm of possibility in a large enterprise. But sort of bear that in mind, that 20,000 IOPS boundary on a storage account, that's going to be, likely something that will drive you to create multiple storage accounts, typically. Okay, so you see that URL, right? So that URL we're going to talk about in just a minute. So here is an Azure virtual machine. So think about your data center. You have your virtual machine with an OS or a data disk, or maybe an OS and a data disk, right? I have my hypervisor, which in this case is not, Hyper-V or anything else. That hypervisor in this case is Azure, right? That's our fabric. Where we sort of see the difference now, when we connect to our storage, we're not connecting through traditional means. You think about, SCSI drivers, et cetera, in a host. We're actually connecting through a web service call, through a RESTful API that is our Azure storage service. So that's where it really, that's where the difference really lies, that the hypervisor is going to convert the call from the operating system, and the call from the operating system, looks just like it does on premises. The difference here is the hypervisor is going to convert that into a web service call.
That's very important to remember.
Yeah, it's good for a couple of reasons, right? Mm-hmm. It's flexible, gives us some creative options in terms of geo-redundancy. It also...
We can move around the VM quite easy.
Yeah, portability goes up with that storage API. There's a certain amount of predictable latency, right? So latency is a fact of life. I'm not saying more latency than normal. I'm saying, milliseconds of a sort. So we'll actually see some consistency about that as we talk about that. So let's talk about, for a moment, how we might improve performance. So just as we have a virtual machine with a single disk, in Hyper-V or anything else, in our on-premises hypervisors, we're going to have some storage limitations. We have some options in Azure to raise the bar in terms of performance. So there are three types of caching. One type is none. Caching is storing frequently used data in memory, And sometimes that none option is really good for disk intensive workloads because our caching is limited by our host in some respects, right? So I'm going to actually let the master talk about that in just a moment. Read-only would be great for sequential IOs. Think SQL log files, right? We typically have our data disk for SQL. We have our log volume. We could move our logs over. And using read-only caching, we can see a nice, healthy boost in performance there. Read-write is actually the default for your operating system disk. It's going to be good for generally light workloads as well, frankly.
Yeah, one thing to remember here is that when we have the storage account, it's like a rack of hard disks. And we create our storage account in there on a number of disks. But here, the caching is stored on the local host, on the local hypervisor, meaning that all the machines share these disks. So if you have noisy neighbors, so other VMs running on the same host, they can affect the performance of the cache. So often it's good to use, but for very disk-intensive workloads, we recommend to disable cache, because else your noisy neighbors can affect your performance in your VM. So it doesn't matter if you buy the biggest one or the smallest VM, they are still the same priority when it comes to cache.
Good point. So if you want to achieve greater IOPS on a single drive, you know, if I set up an E drive for my SQL data, for example, I can create a striped volume with multiple sets, with multiple disks. Are you guys all familiar with software RAID going back to like Windows dot old, whatever, 2003, 2000? Yeah. So you're going
to
be very comfortable with how we stripe a disk stripe disks in Azure. Very familiar. Now, all Azure disks are actually fixed. However, they use this sparse storage mechanism, so you're only charged for the space that's used. So you get the sort of the cost, the space and cost benefits of dynamic with the other benefits of fixed. So it's kind of a best of both worlds.
Fantastic.
It is fantastic, yeah. Actually. That's actually great. It's actually great for billing because you pay for the storage, right? So that's a bit of good news, I think, for sure. So let's sort of flip over to availability for a moment. So we have some options for storage performance. Now we need to make sure it's always running. So within our data center, we've got locally redundant storage, 3 copies in your local Azure site. Now if I want to step that up a notch, I can actually turn on geo-redundant storage, which gives me 3 copies over to a second region hundreds of miles away, so you see an example there. I mentioned striped volumes, right, for better performance. You may use geo-redundant storage for striped volumes, but you must not. Why must not?
You can do it, but it's a quite bad idea, because then one of the disks may end up in Australia, and one of the disks ends up in North Europe. So the performance of the virtual machine can be affected by that.
So that would be non-fantastic.
Non-fantastic, yeah.
For sure. So bear that in mind. So best practices, let's just summarize a bit. If you want to really go all out for IOPS, you can place each data disk in a single storage account, which gives us that 20,000 IOP boundary, right? So that's probably going a little overboard most of the time. Now, if you're scaling up a big workload, maybe not. It depends on the workload, but it should be a rarity.
And it's also quite important there to always remember it's up to 20,000 IOPS.
You know, I feel like my mother's here. He always reminds me, up to.
Yeah, but you never learn.
That's true. Yeah. So always use data disks. You know, why? So what happens when we put an application on the same disk as an OS? We choke the OS, we compete for IOPS, right? So if we've got a 500-ish IOPS boundary for a disk, putting applications onto the OS disk are not going to be a fantastic idea. Stripe disks definitely to allow us to take up to 16 data disks and stripe them, software arrayed, to achieve up to many thousands of IOPS. configure your, you'll see different advice, I think, on the internet around host cache. I think Anders and I are in agreement that you want to base your host cache on the workload. So if you have a disk-intensive workload, the best setting might be none. Read-write maybe for lighter workloads. Read for sequential workloads, for log drives, for example. Never place read-write intensive info on your system drive. So we don't put application data onto the operating system drive so we can keep those appropriately separated from a performance perspective. And never place persistent information on a drive labeled temporary for reasons that I think are obvious to all of us. So every Azure VM has a temporary drive labeled D, so never install to D.
But D is still running on the local host, so the performance can be quite good at D. But each time we reboot the machine, we drop D and we mount a new D. So there is no way to keep the data that you store on D.
Amen. I have to hit the right button.
Yep.
All right, so let's have a look at striped disks. A quick question.
Yes, regarding the D drive.
Yes. So I've never seen anybody recommend to use it. Is it going to hurt anything? So the capacity of D drive, if we go all the way back to that slide with the Azure VM templates, if you could read those myriad numbers, A7 and A8 actually had the same CPU, same memory boundaries, and the same disks and IOPS. What's different about A7 and A8 is the IOPS that their temporary disk can achieve. So I think I would just generally stay away from it. If you had not IO intensive workloads, I'd set up more data disks. If you have IO intensive workloads where you're writing a lot of temporary, then I definitely want data disks so I can scale up my IOPS, right? So I think we tend to just stay away and not even think about it. Why did I? Because it's automatically mounted for us as D.
There are some knowledge-based articles how you can change it if you like. Yeah. If you want to have, for example, some customers moving virtual machines to Azure, they're already using D drive for something else, so they absolutely not want to use D drive. For temporary, and then you can change it. It's a little bit of hacking and tweaking there, but it's possible to do it. And there is like a real guide how to do it. So yeah.
So I ran into this about, I don't know, 3-4 months ago, this summer sometime, where we had an application that was hard coded, and so we did do D, and we ran into a problem later because we set a standard, and then somebody else, you know, from another team came in behind us and deployed some virtual machines, and they didn't know about that, you know, you have to change the temporary drive letter, so they sort of broke our standard because they let Azure do what it does. So as long as you sort it out from a process perspective, so every time you onboard a new workload, you change that in a consistent fashion, as long as you manage it, I guess. It makes me nervous thinking about changing it unless it's a very special occasion.
So, should we look at striped volumes, striped disks?
Let's do it.
Yeah. So here I have a machine, virtual machine. And if we go into the virtual machine, we can see that we have a number of disks mounted to it. And
so Anders, are these disks that you uploaded ahead of time, or did you create these on the fly? How does it work?
So I actually created them. I didn't upload them, but it's absolutely possible to upload. If you have one disk or disks that you like, you can of course upload them to Azure and use them in your virtual machines. But these disks, I just created them for the demo here.
So you created empty disks, in other words.
Yeah, it's quite easy. You click here, you click add, attach, empty disk. So it's not that complicated.
Yeah, yep. I like it.
Right. So If we go in and look at the disks, we go up here to disks, and we have a list of all the disks I'm using, and we pick one of these. We can take this one, for example, edit. Then we have the possibility to change the cache mode here that Pete was talking about earlier. You want to say something about that?
I don't.
No. So then let's go into the virtual machine. In the virtual machine, the disks will show up as they have done since the 80s. And we just right-click and say new striped volume and just select all the disks, and then you have your striped volume.
How do you know that the disks look like this in the 80s?
So something about my age again.
So actually, I think he's wrong, but it's actually a fact that he was in diapers for part of the 80s. So I think it's not exactly true.
Yeah, you have, in the 80s, you had already been working 25 years in the IT business.
I would have been changing your diapers in the 80s, yes.
Yeah. You're so old, so you're
I still feel like I'm changing his diapers some days, but you know.
Yeah. You're just jealous because you're dreaming in black and white. That's how old you are.
Indeed.
So we can see here that it's quite easy to attach more disks, and then in Windows we just build a striped volume the same way we have always done.
And you can, as you're provisioning virtual machines with Azure PowerShell, you can do exactly the same thing. I can spin up a VM based on, you know, my image, a gallery image, and I can create and attach multiple disks.
Question?
Yeah, I apologize. If you have questions, if you make a little noise, it's super dark. Yeah. Fire away.
I have a question. If you have your storage on the set, it's already virtual storage, so all the load is already divided through the disks. Why would you still stripe a disk, for example?
So when we move to Azure, so you have a, let's say you have a VHD,
yeah,
for sake of argument, on your SAN. Your SAN is virtual storage that's giving you capacity through the methodology of a SAN, which is going to be with SSD or SATA or other drives, right? And each of those has an IOP capacity. So with Azure, that boundary for what that VHD is going to be able to do changes, because a single VHD, a single disk, is going to have a boundary of 500 IOPS. So I'm going to have to take that drive, and I'm going to have to add multiple disks and stripe, because I'm just dealing with a completely different storage architecture. So it's kind of the Azure SAN.
So there is a limit per disk, and there is a limit in the storage account where we store the disks.
Yeah, indeed. So when I think about a storage account and that 20,000 IOPS, in my mind, that's sort of a mini SAN, and with multiple accounts, I can extend my SAN. That's how I keep it straight in my head. So Anders ran some performance reports, yeah, or so some performance testing.
Yes, I did. We have them here.
So there we don't want to put you to sleep with numbers, but we did want to explain a few things. So
yeah, and it can be quite difficult to see too, so we can just explain them.
Yeah. So basically, if you add disks, if I want to raise my I/O capacity, so here we had performance with two disks in a RAID array. So without RAID, we hit around 100 IOPS. With two disks, we hit about 130 IOPS. So it was about a 30% bump when we added the second disk. The latency, however, was about 1,200 milliseconds either way. So when we added disks, latency did not improve. IOPS improved, latency did not. So Anders, why did latency remain consistent.
So the minimum latency when we were running these tests for like 10, 15 minutes was 6 milliseconds, and the average was 15, and maximum was 1,100. And that's because if you think back to the slide where Pete explained how disk operation works, that we convert everything into requests to the Azure storage service, that's why we see the latency there. And as we said before, it's up to 20,000 IOPS, but also there, you only have your little storage account in the huge rack with hard disks. So if the neighbors are very noisy and doing a lot at the same time, then that can affect your performance.
So average latency, though, around 15 milliseconds, so quite low in the grand scheme of things. When we look at read performance, latency, again, very consistent. It was around 25, 30 milliseconds in this case. Our IOPS did not improve, frankly, when we went up.
Yeah.
So read performance, you know, it's gonna depend on the workload. But we see that when we look at IOP reports on the internet.
And we didn't have caching here.
And we didn't have caching enabled here. We were doing this without cache. So if we'd played around with our workload, we might achieve better performance through optimizing cache based on whether it's disk intensive, it's sequential write, or a light workload. So here we bumped it to four disks. So
four disks in striped volume, and we also configured a workload to write in 8 threads instead of 2.
So the IOPS went way up there. So we went from 100 IOPS write with one disk up to about 420 with 4. So the IO went up. On the read side, that 400 number here was about 270 over here, again without caching. So with read, we see things falling off a bit. So it's gonna warrant experimenting with the cache to maximize your performance. Let's talk about high availability.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, you should use that. That's better. So there is a knowledge base article about striping disks on Azure machines. And if you're running 2012, a little bit later, newer operation system, you should use storage spaces. Yeah.
Indeed. So high availability. We can think about high availability in terms of our operating system. We can think about high availability in terms of our applications. So let's sort of take those two as separate topics for a moment. So with our operating system, you remember we had exactly one network adapter per virtual machine, right? Which means failover clustering as we know it wouldn't work here exactly, right? Because we wouldn't be able to set up our separate network adapters, et cetera. In fact, your Azure virtual machines are typically going to be dynamically addressed with a consistent address. So we're not going to be in configuring the IP stack. Typically, high availability in Azure will be achieved through concepts like availability sets, which we'll look at in a moment. Network load balancing, we'll take a look at how we can load balance our workloads, and then storage redundancy, which we just saw. So let's start with availability sets. So in your data center, when you're trying to achieve high availability, it's all about eliminating single points of failure, right? So I want to eliminate failure in my storage, my host, my power, my network, etc. So I do that lots of times by making sure virtual machines are in different fault domains. I put them in different racks, right? So in Azure, I can create an availability set. Spreads our virtual machines across Azure's definition of fault domains. Going to prevent an outage with hardware failure, with updates, etc. So it's like putting your VMs in separate racks. It's quite literally about what it amounts to. It separates them in terms of fault domains, and then when we apply updates, they'll be in their own update domain. So we're building in some high availability here.
What we can add on there is that those updates are fabric updates. So it's updates that Microsoft do to the fabric. So it's not Windows patches to your virtual machines.
Yeah, important point. We're talking about the host updates at this point. So when the hypervisor, et cetera, beneath our VMs is being updated, we always know that at least one on each side of the availability set is available. So too close is going to be a single point of failure. The availability set is our vehicle to separate our VMs into a fault domain. Let's have a look at availability sets in Azure. This is also quite easy, and really everything we're showing you here in the UI, as you can probably imagine if you don't already know, is possible in PowerShell as well.
So here we have two virtual machines that are providing the same kind of service. So open up the first one here. Go to the Configure tab. And then I have Availability Sets down here.
Hey, so look up top there, too. You see the virtual machine tier, basic and standard. Remember I mentioned that you have 300 IOPS on the basic tier, 500 per disk on the standard. There's your checkbox.
Yeah. So I create a new availability set. Let's call it Service Manager. Save that one.
So incidentally, for you System Center folks out there, which I'm guessing are many, there is a KB article that explains, that articulates System Center support in Azure. So product by, component by component explains which System Center components are supported running in Azure virtual machines, in IaaS, if you will. And I think the short answer there is most. Certainly you wouldn't run Virtual Machine Manager up there, but things like Operations Manager, absolutely.
So what's going on now in the background is that we will reconfigure this machine. So we will, as this machine now should be in one of the update domains, it will now be shut down and we will reconfigure it and reboot it again. And once that is done, I can go into my next machine, Service Manager 02. I can click Configure. And on this one, that availability set that I just created will show up, and I pick this machine here and click save on that one too. And that means that those two machines, one of those will always be online. So they are now rebooted and reconfigured in two different fault domains. So two different racks, two different switches, two different power, two different everything. So there is no way that both of these machines will be rebooted at the same time when we patch the fabric.
So when would availability sets be a good idea? A web farm, right? Something that scales out. Let's think about availability sets in System Center terms. Do you ever want to patch all of your SCUM management servers at the same time? Definitely not. So an availability, if I'm hosting Operations Manager in Azure, I could have an availability set with, one, two, three or more management servers, and I could separate those fault domains so as we have updates to the fabric, I never lose all of my management servers.
And we can now see that Service Manager 01 is completed, and now Service Manager Availability Set shows up here on Service Manager 02, so I can now configure this machine too. And now normally, someone asks if I have five machines, can I make sure that 2.5 is online all the time? No, you can't. So when you put machines into these availability sets, they are just split between the two update domains, and there are two update domains there, or fault domains there. Yeah. Two of them, not five or three or so on, there are two. So we will just split the machines between them.
And so that right there tells us, gives us some data when we're planning as to how much we, how much capacity we need to build into each of those systems that are going to be in that application tier, whatever that application is. All right, so let's talk about some application-specific HA options. So network load balancing is possible in Azure, refreshingly easy compared to what you'll experience on-prem. SQL always on, so I mentioned traditional failover clustering isn't possible. SQL always on availability groups are supported in Microsoft Azure. Great documentation out there on how to configure always on. And as of last June, I think was when, June 2013, I think it was, that Microsoft announced auto scale was possible for Azure VMs, for IaaS. So if I have a scale out workload, like a web farm, for example, and I have a burst in the morning, where I see a peak, I can configure auto scale when my VMs hit a certain resource threshold to provision another, and maybe another. So I can auto scale out that application tier that scales horizontally. So that's typically going to be something that can be load balanced. So let's talk about Azure load balancer, your load balancing in particular. So creating what we call a load balanced set. So Azure Load Balancer works at layer 4, so IP plus port. So we think about that as more of a session-based load balancing, right? automatically configures itself to scale to more or fewer instances. So if we think about it in conjunction with that auto scale feature, as I add more hosts in that tier, my load balancer is going to handle that for me. In your data center, load balancing is loads of fun, right? So we can do NLB. How many of you use NLB today? How many of you enjoy NLB? So I saw the hands go down really fast. We can use specialized hardware, right? So we can use Riverbeds and F5s and Citrix NetScalers. In Azure, load balancing is 10-ish clicks in the UI. I'm not setting any specialized appliances up. I'm clicking the mouse a few times. Anders, let's load balance something.
Yep, something. I will find something. Right, so here I have two web servers, O1 and O3. So if I want to load balance the web page that they are providing, I just click on endpoints. But should you say something about endpoints here?
Endpoints, yeah. That's
we haven't really talked about that.
We haven't talked about endpoints. So endpoints are how you connect to your virtual machine. So out of the box, when you create an Azure VM, it has two endpoints. One is for PowerShell. One is for remote desktop. What an endpoint gives me is public, you know, external connectivity into that virtual machine. So when an Azure VM comes up, if you don't have Active Directory policies to disable remote desktop will be available. Now, if I have, you all have heard of Azure site-to-site VPN, right? I can connect my corporate data center to Azure. So if I have Azure VMs and I have a site-to-site VPN with Azure, so my data center, you know, can route to and from Azure, I do not need endpoints. I can remote desktop to a server on TCP port 3389, which is the default, right? An endpoint gives me an external hole, so it's bad. I'm still talking, and I'm not done yet. So that can be a problem, and we'll talk about where those endpoints come in. But if you're using Azure as an extension of your corporate data center, I'm not going to leave these RDP endpoints on here. I'm gonna tear them down. I'm gonna get rid of them because it's a security hole. Because I'm exposing I'm increasing my attack surface.
Thank you, Pete.
I'll
that
stop.
Was a quick explanation. So if we want to add an endpoint here so internet can access our machines, we do add. We say standalone endpoint. We select service or name here. It's easy.
See, I don't know if you noticed there were several protocols available in the endpoint.
Yep, there's a long list.
There you go.
And we say create a load balance set. We need to input a name here. Let's say web page. We can configure how often we will probe the different nodes here. That will be fine.
There we go. So that's setting up a load balance set, right? So I didn't need specialized networking skills, appliances, hardware.
We're not really done yet. Now we only have one machine in there.
You are killing
me.
So
we go to number three also, and we do add. And add. This time. Let's do this.
I think you're still waiting.
Yeah, I think we are. Update in progress, yes. Oh, right.
Well, see, I could have been talking all that time.
Yeah, you could.
Thank you.
Now we can pick.
There you go. All right.
Web page. Name, web page. Like that. And we're also adding now this machine to our load balancing set. And if we now go to our cloud service, where both of these machines are a member, Geek Cloud, we have it. We can see the address. Go back one. Here it is. Click on that one. And we see that we are now on the first server. And if I go and find another server.
Can you zoom? I can't see that even from here.
But you see that it's red. Or you see this is in black and white, no?
I do see it is in red.
Yeah, yes. Okay, that's good. So now we are on the first server in our load balancing set. And if we copy this address, and you can try it too, because it's published to internet now, we can take another machine here. See where we end up this time. Oh, so on this machine, we end up on the blue server. Let me zoom that one. And that's the O3 machine. So by like 10 clicks or five, I think I have 11 steps there, we have managed to build a load balancing set. So it's a little bit easier than convincing the network team to build this. That will take them forever. Another nice thing here, if we go back to our machines, here we have them. We take, for example, the first one here. We go back to endpoints. We can just want to show this one. You can actually configure which IP addresses that will have permission to access the machine. So if you want to have just a remote desktop of one specific IP number, that's possible to configure here.
So where I see this in the field, where we see this in the field might be with a load balanced farm that's exposing a web service, a B2B web service, for example. I might want to use ACLs to make sure only my business partners can get to that API. So that's gonna reduce my my exposure, with sensitive business data.
Yep. Back to you.
Right. So the load balancing piece, pretty straightforward. Yeah. Good. So let's talk about management for a moment. So Azure now includes a VM management agent, and this management agent enables additional management functions. Imagine that. There are some pretty standard agent extensions, like BG Info, which I think most of you may remember that BG Info, I think, came from SysInternals, which was Mark Rosenovich, who's now more or less the head of Azure. RDP, we can enable RDP, and there's actually a local admin password reset capability there, so I can use PowerShell to automate some of those functions. In the UI, there are some additional functions that are lit up as well. You'll see some configuration extensions, Chef and Puppet agents, which are popular management platforms you might see used with non-Windows operating systems, Linux specifically, although those systems will interact with Windows machines as well. Custom scripts, so I can run, say, a PowerShell script against a VM. There are also some security extensions that have been added. So the most recent is Microsoft's anti-malware. You'll see there's a semantic endpoint option. There's a Trend micro security agent option there as well. So antivirus baked in. Automating Azure operations. How many orchestrator folks do we have in here? A few? Couple, yeah. So Azure, as you may be aware, has its own automation engine called Azure Automation. So like SMA, Azure Automation is based on PowerShell workflow. It can be leveraged to automate tasks like starting and stopping VMs, stripping those pesky external endpoints I was talking about that are security holes. Those are actually the two most common things I see it used for. Scheduling, shutting VMs down that don't need to run 24 hours, that controls our spend because Azure bills by the minute. Do bear in mind with storage, so we talked about storage being something that's billed, based on usage, right? It's also billed on transactions, so when I reboot a virtual machine, my transactions temporarily go up to the storage tier, so there's a little more expense there. So I want to just bear that in mind. It's not a lot of money, but it's something to think about. Why don't we look at that scheduled restart option? Let's have a look at Azure Automation.
Yep.
Bearing in mind that if you're using service management automation or you're thinking about using service management automation, what you use in SMA can be pretty easily scooped up and used in Azure because Azure Automation is really SMA as a service.
Right.
What do you have?
Yes. So here I have Azure Automation, and if you've been working with SMA, you recognize it. It looks really exactly the same. I have created two runbooks here, one that runs every morning, one that runs every evening. And as Pete said earlier, well, you said quite a lot, is that you're paying per minute for your virtual machines. So if you're not using them during night, you might want to turn them off. And if you not need the same amount of hardware during night, you can scale down a little bit.
What are you looking at me for?
Looks like you're going to say something.
I'm waiting for you to show me something.
Yeah. So here, I have created a runbook that connects to a SQL database that's also stored in Azure and reads configuration for my virtual machine. Machines here. So if I look here in my database, this is my Azure database. So it's platform as a service, a normal SQL database.
Hey, do me a favor and zoom in there, just so we can see this. So Anders is calling out something pretty important here. So he's storing information about which virtual machines need to be powered on and off on a schedule, and he's storing it in an Azure database. You might have a CMDB where you store this. At the end of the day, from an Azure Automation runbook, I can call any sort of data source, right? If it's a database, if it's a web service, whatever, if it's a spreadsheet, you know, who cares? We just need a place to find that data.
Yes. So here I have my database with a table where you can see server names and the configuration for day and the configuration for night. So my runbook that I can configure to run every, so this is the morning runbook, so it runs every morning, 7:30, and it reads the configuration for my virtual machines, reconfigure them, and make sure they are on and correct size. And then I have another runbook running every evening that shuts down some machines and change the configuration of some other machines.
So great, you know, definitely for test and development workloads or applications that, you know, don't need to be online 24/7. So as you begin to move workloads into Azure, you can think with a little more granularity about, you know, how often do I need that machine to be up and available to my you know, user population, to my consumers.
Yeah.
And maybe be a little more aggressive than you would be in your own data center, because we have a very real dollars and cents cost here.
Exactly. We have some customers that have these huge machines to generate reports and process data in the end of each month. Here they can easily run it on small hardware, and then in the end of the month they scale it out and have really a lot of hardware resources, and then after a couple of days they can just scale it down again.
So Anders, if I have a workload that is very small, you know, 29 days of the month, and then on the 30th day it's huge, can I go in and pick a new image size for that VM?
Yes, you can.
Okay.
You want me to show?
I want you to show them. So if I need to scale up once a month, I can scale up once a month. I don't size the VM, you know, necessarily for every day based on my biggest day. I size it for today. I size it for right now, and I think about scaling up a little more precisely. And what you see in the UI, we can do with Azure Automation on a schedule. You can log that data somewhere and query it out and make those changes very, very much automatic.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's quite inexpensive. You know, Anders is using an Azure SQL database.
Exactly.
To store that data, and he's not just doing that because he works for Microsoft. Well, he may be, right? But it's also quite inexpensive when you're using small databases out there.
Exactly.
Right? So you get some free there.
And I don't have to administrate any fabric, I just using it.
Yeah, at the end of the day he wants a table to query, so it's actually a really smart decision because it's inexpensive or free to use at very low scale.
Yeah. So switching over to you.
Thank you. So let's talk about self-service. So we're not all using self-service today. Certainly, you know, the big scary DevOps talk we had in the keynote, self-service is something that helps us get out of the way of our consumers and move on to more interesting, compelling management tasks. So with self-service for Azure, we have two options natively out of the box. We have the Azure portal that Anders has been working in repeatedly today. There's a system center component you may be aware of called App Controller, which is a lightweight interface, a little less exciting and capable than the Azure portal, to be sure. Each of these interfaces, you know, I think of the Azure portal as the full-featured adult version, and I think of App Controller as the lightweight, you know, good tool for, say, a dev or an IT pro to interact with some machines when we need to start them up, shut them down, take a checkpoint, that sort of thing. But they both share some common problems. Neither of these platforms.
Yeah, they have some challenges, yes.
Oh, what? I didn't want to know.
Well, the problem with App Controller is that either you have all permissions or you have none permissions. So if you think about you're sharing one subscription for your organization and you let people use App Controller.
So like the bottom there, it gives users access to all gallery images?
Have you just added that one?
Yeah, I think you just don't read good, but okay. So he really hadn't seen that before. So there's no ITSM integration. So if you're using, whether you're using Service Manager or CA or HP or ServiceNow, neither of these tools are going to give you integration to say handle approval, right? We want accountability if we want to prevent VM sprawl. If I, as a dev or an ops guy, can go deploy all the VMs I want and you don't know, I'm going to deploy whatever I want. I'm not going to be careful about shutting them down, and your spend is going to go crazy, and you're not going to be happy. There's no reporting. You know, as Anders said, with App Controller and with you know, the full portal alike, you know, self-service users can create endpoints, which create attack surface.
So even if you have one subscription that you share, the problem is that they can affect different VMs, different resources that they shouldn't touch. And if you then have multiple subscriptions for multiple teams within your organization, then as Pete is saying, then they can deploy whatever they want because you can't limit their gallery images. So if you have a, let's say you have a policy internally that you need to run a specific antivirus, there is no way to control that. So there are some challenges with the App Controller.
So let's look at ITSM integrated self-service. So I think what's important to understand here, Anders is going to be working in System Center. I think what's important to understand is you know, your ITSM system, you know, typically has a web interface, right? You can fill out an incident. So we have that presentation layer, right? And beneath that, whether you're using Orchestrator or SMA or Azure Automation, you have a layer of automation that you can use to drive what Anders is demonstrating here, regardless of your front end, right? The front end is frankly the easy part a lot of times.
Yeah, so what we see here is the Service Manager portal. And you might want to take a look at the Travis Serison portal.
Yeah. certainly for System Center, if you're using System Centers or CMDB, there are some nicer portals out there. Cyrison, who's
yeah,
here,
they,
at, here
the,
at this
the
conference,
portal they
is
have
one of those.
Is really, really nice.
Yeah.
But the idea here is that someone requests a new machine. And notice that we also have the expire date here. So when you request the machine, you have to import the expire date. And that's quite handy, so someone cleans up.
Give us a zoom for the back row just so they see what you're talking about there.
This one.
There you go.
Yeah, expire date. So you have to pick a date when you request the machine, and that's quite nice. So we have seen at customers that people request machines, deploy machines, and then no one using them. So after this date, we can clean up the environment. So requesting machines are not that complicated. We have done that before. And then we have a ticket in Service Manager, someone asking for our machine. So we get some kind of tracking here. We get approval steps that Pete was talking about. So it's easy for us now to see who requested this machine, who approved it, what's the business justification, and so on. And what we also can do is that behind Service Manager, we can, of course, integrate with orchestrator, or if you want to use SMA, you can integrate SMA with Service Manager. I think Sirison, they also have a nice connector there between Service Manager and SMA, so you can use whatever engine you like there. But as you can see here, we are building the machine in Azure, but we are also creating a CI in our CMDB.
So what's a CI?
Configuration item.
So we're creating a record of that virtual machine in our configuration management
exactly.
database.
So if we go in here and look at the machine, we can see, for example, here, that it's in the Azure North Europe Active Directory site. And that's quite handy, because if people are starting deploying machines in Azure, IT still wants to know, what's that machine? Where did that show up? So we want to create our record in our CMDB so we can keep track of what we have in Azure.
So what I love about that is you don't even really have to extend the CMDB in any special way. We just named our Active Directory site as something with Azure in it. So now we immediately know that this is an Azure VM because it's sitting in the Azure North Europe data center.
And once you have it in there, then you can run all the normal reports and quite easy and quick see the different cost centers, what kind of machines they have in Azure, how much you're paying for them, when they are about to expire, and you can also run some nice graphs like this.
Yeah, so certainly some nice possibilities to you know, connect Azure back to whatever. ITSM platform you have.
Yeah, so the thing here is that you're just buying a virtual machine from Microsoft, nothing else. So you still have to have something in front, and you still need to do all the management and so on, and keep track of all the machines.
Yeah, and Anders was capturing, you know, an expiration date there, so you can use that to delete virtual machines, you can use that to shut them down, you can use that to send maybe an aging report to the owner of that virtual machine.
Yeah.
It's another thing we can do with Service Manager. We automatically capture who asked for that machine. We can, you know, certainly capture who owns it, right?
Yeah, that's easy. There's even a blog post on my blog about how to build the expire date run books that will send the email, ask people to extend the expire date, and so on. Did we mention outgoing traffic when we're talking management?
I'm not sure we did. So we didn't talk about operation, you know, about monitoring and you know, just generally sending data over to your data center. So if you have System Center agents, config man, ops man, whatever, if you are managing Azure VMs with those systems, you don't pay for data going into Azure, you know, ingress, you pay for data coming out, egress. So we want to think about how we're managing these VMs and how much data we're sending out, which means I might want to look at services like Windows Azure Backup, for example, and look at maybe keeping my data backed up in Azure, so I'm paying for, you know, cheap storage and not lots and lots of data flowing out on premises where I'm, you know, then going to have, you know, to copy it back up to recover anyway.
Or if you're running Operation Manager.
Yeah, if I'm running Operations Manager, sending lots of agent traffic back to the data center might not be what I want to do. I could, you know, I could certainly host Operations Manager in Azure VMs and make it highly available and make it very, you know, very scalable.
Good, we are almost out of time, so.
Indeed. So you know, that was our first pass with you at the big three. So performance and scale, high availability for VMs and apps, you know, a quick look at monitoring and management and even self-service. So hopefully this gives you some ideas about how you can step into Azure a bit more comfortably and a bit more, you know, a bit more safely. You know, bearing cost and everything in mind. So again, feedback. So I think this is the last slide between you
and Beers.
Well, so between all of us and Beers, frankly. So we're going to race you. So remember, INETX is offering donations for all feedback. So if you, we really appreciate the feedback, so we can do better next year. Be honest.
But generous?
Be generous first and honest next. you know, I hope you enjoyed the session, guys. If any questions, we're going to be here. Happy to pass a mic around, what have you. And If not, I think party time is
now.
Soon coming.
Yeah. Thank you.